Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane is having a voice treatment and will be back on the air soon. From Broadway to the Beltway, Rocco Landisman arrived in Washington almost 6 months ago to take the helm of the National Endowment for the Arts. As the 10th chairman of the NEA, he heads a grant-making agency whose very existence was threatened during the so-called culture wars of the 1990s. The Broadway producer of such hits as Angels in America and The Producers, Rocco Landisman joins me in the studio to talk about the NEA under his leadership and the role of arts in America. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks, Susan. Good to be here.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation. You can call our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org.
I was taken aback when you said, I've been here 6 months. The clock is really ticking.
Yeah.
someone said the other day, well, you've got 37 months. And I thought, my God, that's not much time to get things done.
You were an enormously successful producer on Broadway. So why did you want this job at the NEA, and why did you get it?
Well, the first question first. I wish I could say that I was drafted by the president, that he canvassed all the possible NEA chairmen and twisted my arm to do this. I actually put my hand up for it. I volunteered. And I did it because I felt if you're ever going to do public service, this would be the time. If not with this president, with this administration, when would you ever do it? It wouldn't happen. Then you might as well just write checks and serve on a couple of boards, and that's your social commitment.
How did you know Barack Obama?
I'd had a lunch with him before he even decided to run for president, maybe a year before he made that decision, and found him different than any other politician I had encountered. A very thoughtful guy, interested in conversation, actually listens. We would have a back and forth. I had the feeling that his mind wasn't necessarily totally made up about every single thing. He was a very refreshing and interesting guy to know, and from that time I was taken with him and did my small part when he ran on Broadway to raise money for him.
How different is it to run the NEA, a government agency, with running your own corporation, which you did for so many years?
Night and day. At my company, if I decide to do something, we just do it. I'll say, this is what's going to happen, and it happens. Now, if I decide to do something, it's explained to me, first of all, why it can't be done. You know, there are always five or six reasons why that's impossible. And if I'm eventually able to wear everybody down to where we decided can be done, well, that's going to take 6 months to a year. Yeah, nothing happens fast. And there is a frustration level. I was told by one cabinet head, if there's not a certain frustration level, you're probably not doing your job correctly, because you should be bumping up against the edges of the doable. You should be constantly, you know, pressing the envelope and trying to get things done, and you won't be able to get everything done right away.
You said that you thought, if not this president, who? A different kind of president. But it's been a tough year, and President Obama has hit a tough patch now.
It's early. It's very early.
What's your attitude about that?
It was very interesting Sunday before this one to see Bob Woodward on Meet the Press, and he was talking about when Ronald Reagan came in. And Reagan is widely perceived to have had one of the most successful presidencies, whether you agree or disagree with what he did. He was certainly very, very successful. He got a lot of what he wanted to do accomplished. After the first year, they were saying he's not even going to run again. He's so unpopular. The economy is in terrible shape. He's in trouble. And this is going to be a one-term presidency. Well, nothing could have been more wrong. I think it's a little premature to make judgments about what's going to happen. One thing we've learned from the different bumps in the road along the campaign is that this is a very resourceful and resilient person, the president. And I think things are going to be fine in time. I do.
You spoke to the U.S. Conference of Mayors in Washington last week and announced a new grants program. Tell us about that.
There's an organization called the Mayors Institute of City Design, which is an NEA-sponsored organization. And what we're going to be doing is making grants in various cities across the country in the area of design and planning to try to jumpstart neighborhood and economic development in various of these cities with the arts as a fulcrum. And we're very excited about about this program. We believe that art is an important part of neighborhood revitalization, part of economic development in many cities across the country. We think the arts have a central role to play in that. We're going to be expending significant amounts of our own funds there from the NEA, but also trying to leverage that with funds from elsewhere in the federal government, and that's never happened before.
Where else could you get money in the federal government to do this?
Well, all of the agencies have aspects of arts funding and programming in them. The State Department, for instance, has a big arts budget. In the Department of Defense, they're the biggest purchaser of musical instruments in the country. And in this plan we have for our urban areas, there are a number of federal agencies that do work that directly relates to the kind of programs that we're talking about. Department of Housing and Urban Development, Department of Education, Transportation, Health and Human Services. And what we want to do is find the points of intersection that the arts has with each one of these and find ways that we can work together. One of the big themes, Susan, in this administration is that these agencies are not just individual silos, which sometimes work at cross purposes, that to the extent that there can be real collaboration and contact among these agencies around particular initiatives, everything is going to be much, much more effective. I think that's obvious, but for some reason it doesn't seem to happen.
Our phone lines are open. You can give us a call at 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email to drshow@wamu.org or send us a question on Twitter or on Facebook. Well, when you think about the mission of the National Endowment for the Arts, is it to foster and support the best artists in America, the most creative people, or is it to make arts available across the country, which in some cases might not be the very best artists in the country?
It's a great question. As if those two things are mutually exclusive and incompatible, which is ridiculous. You know, you read some of the conservative press. There was an article in the Weekly Standard that said the NEA is at an inflection point, and I'm about to bring it down because I'm going to be emphasizing art and artists at the NEA. How silly is that? That the NEA should be supporting art and should be supporting artists is controversial. I mean, that's, you know, I almost hesitate to respond to it. It's so ridiculous. Of course, we're going to be supporting art and artists. That's what we do. We're the National Endowment for the Arts. Now we're going to be supporting that wherever it occurs, not just in the big cities. And of course, we're also going to be promoting access to the arts and the availability of the arts all across the country. We've always done that. We're going to continue to do that. And the idea is that one is exclusive of the other is silly.
Although you got into a little bit of hot water with the comment you made about Peoria.
Ah, Peoria.
Here's what you said. I don't know if
I have
there's...
to keep listening to this.
Yes,
I made my bed. I have to lie in it, I guess.
You said, I don't know if there's a theater in Peoria, but I would bet that it's not as good as Steppenwolf or The Goodman, which are, of course, two very notable theaters mm-hmm. in Chicago. Some people thought that sounded kind of snobbish.
Well, it wasn't meant to be. First of all, remember that I'm a Broadway person, and there's a old-time Broadway expression, a vaudeville expression, really, will it play in Peoria? So Peoria was meant as a kind of generic reference. It wasn't particular to Peoria itself, although as it turned out, it ended up being a very, very happy thing for both Peoria and the NEA. I went out there.
Peoria got in touch with you, I guess,
They did, and I responded to them right away and made a commitment to go out there, and I did. And I have to say, there was an immediate affinity. I'm a Midwesterner from St. Louis, which is about 3 hours away. They're very direct Midwesterners, and their attitude, which could have been indignant, offended, hostile, was anything but. They said, come out here. We've got a whole art scene. We have theater. There's a lot going on. Come out and check it out. And I did. And there is a very vibrant art scene in Peoria. And I think this visit has been a catalyst for that community to come together and work as a unit to try to advance their cause. I think for the NEA, it's been a way to show that we will go anywhere and will support art everywhere. I mean, no. I think the people in Peoria would be the first to say that a community theater, which they have there, several of them, which are not professional theaters, the actors aren't paid, are not in the same part of the food chain, to use an expression that they use, as the Goodman or Steppenwolf, and I haven't really rescinded that point of view. It doesn't mean that it's not worthy and worthy of support and doing important work. There's important work done in the arts across the spectrum, and the NEA has been supporting that and will continue to.
You know, you're known as an outspoken, colorful guy. You've got black alligator cowboy boots on, although on radio, I guess that's hard for listeners to see. Do you worry that being in Washington means that you have to really watch every word, that you can't speak as freely as you used to?
That's been an issue for me. I tend to be very freewheeling in what I do and say, and I've had to be more cautious, to be more careful. To some extent, I can't buy into the total ethos here, which is to some degree a culture of fear, people being afraid to say something they're going to get in trouble for and constantly looking over their shoulder. You know, I'm not going to spend the next 4 years here playing defense. And there are some things that I've said. If people want to parse this in the wrong way or twist it, I can't help it, but I'm going to stick to my point of view. This whole elitism thing that you just referred to is a case in point. This whole notion that if you apply some kind of standards, have standards, some kind of evaluative metric, that's elitist. Well, I don't know where that comes from. I don't see how that's the case. That's not elitism. That's just having standards, and we're going to apply standards of artistic excellence to whatever we do. And I think that's something I would think even conservatives, especially conservatives, maybe would support.
We're talking to Rocco Landisman, chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll take your questions and calls. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio this hour, Rocco Landisman. He's chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. He's from St. Louis, went to the University of Wisconsin at Madison, studied at Yale, and he's the producer of some of the biggest hits on Broadway, Big River, Angels in America, and The Producers. We're going to go to the phones in just a moment. First, let me ask you, this recession that has affected the whole country, to what degree has it affected the arts in America?
Tremendously. I mean, you have arts institutions all across the country that are in big, big trouble, in financial crisis, and it's a big concern of ours that a lot of them are going to be going out of business over the next 6 months to a year. I did feel, however, that I remember having this thought as soon as I was nominated, long before I was confirmed, that if we simply made the case to Congress and inside the administration that X, Y, and Z arts institutions were in trouble, that the San Francisco Mime Troupe needs X money to survive, the Pacific Opera is going out of business, that the response would be, boy, that's terrible. It's a shame. We hate to see that happen, but we have more important priorities on our plate right now than saving arts institutions. So I felt I had to develop a narrative where I could take it around town, as it were, and get a hearing. And that has to do, I think, with the role of arts in coming out of this recession and an economic revitalization. And I think we have a big role to play in that, and that's what people are going to be hearing from me over the next few years.
Well, we know that the arts nurture the spirit, but to what
Totally.
Degree do the arts play a role in revitalizing the economy?
There was a study, there have been a number of studies, but the best one I know of is a 10-year study done by the University of Pennsylvania about Philadelphia and Baltimore. and the role of the arts in those cities. And they came to three, I think, very major conclusions. The first is that when you have a strong cultural presence in a community, there's much more civic engagement. People who tend to be involved in the arts also tend to be involved in other institutions, other activities. So you have a much more cohesive community when you have the arts. Secondly, it's proven that where there's strong arts presence, there is significantly measurably lower rates of truancy and juvenile delinquency. And finally, it's been proven with quite a bit of data supporting this that arts is a poverty fighter, that if you bring art and artists into the center of town, it changes that town profoundly, that the economics of that town changes, the tax base changes. One of the things we've learned is that people don't follow businesses. The businesses follow the people. They look for a workforce that is motivated, educated, committed, and people follow other people. When you poll this workforce, where do you want to go? The two things they always mention are education and culture. So if you have strong educational and cultural presence in a town, it attracts people. Those people attract other people. Businesses follow. And you get a virtuous cycle that is very, very notable.
So if cities want to attract businesses or want to attract some of those highly educated young people that can really help the economy, they should be focused in
part
on
the first thing you should do is bring in artists. Artists' residences, workspaces, because they will attract others. The people come first. To twist that great line in one of my favorite movies, Field of Dreams, if you come, they will build it.
And yet we're at a time when we see 10% joblessness, much higher in some states. We see a lot of pressure on health and education and welfare programs. And some people would say, you know, the arts are great, but they're the icing on the cake. And at a time of limited resources, we really need to focus on these other core things.
They're not the icing on the cake at all. They're the cake. The arts are fundamental to who we are as human beings. They're part of our self-expression. And I think you'll find in the educational system, for example, the arts catch a lot of these kids who maybe don't perform on standardized tests in reading or math. The kid who's got a special talent, an idiosyncratic point of view, a passion about something. The arts catch these kids and find a place for them in the world and in the society, and the arts play a very significant role there. They're also very, very important in terms of how the arts can affect us and make us better.
Let's go to the phones. We'll go first to Woodstock, but not the Woodstock in New York, Woodstock, Illinois, and talk to Lydia. Lydia, thank you for joining us.
Well, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I think the arts are undervalued. If you actually look historically, the role of arts have been the primary factor in producing change. Toynbee talks about the way arts are initiated by individuals and not by massive, large groups or, for instance, corporations, as we're now discussing, being the vehicle for thought process. And I think we need to understand it from that value, and we need to support it from that value. My business model is based on the arts, and I consider myself to be a social entrepreneur. And because I'm incorporated, I will fight some of the political injustices that I see developing, in light of, for instance, the corporate rights that are given to large institutions. I will utilize those rights as an artist and push back and fight back, and I hope other people will consider to do the same.
All right, Lydia, thanks so much for your call.
All right, thank you.
I'm glad to have this as the first question, because one of the things that I've come to really understand is that artists are entrepreneurs. They're small business people. They're placemakers. They really can change a community on a one-to-one basis. They have, in effect, small businesses. That's what artists do. And to the extent that you can get a cluster of them in a place, they're going to change that place and transform it.
Here's a question you may like less well. It's from Tom. It's an email from Tom Hendricks, who identifies himself as the editor of the web magazine Musea. And he says, The NEA should get out of the art decision business and help set up regional art centers open to all local and traveling artists and all arts, not just an NEA chosen few. Let the community decide region by region. He writes, the NEA has not had a good track record for choosing and funding great art. Well, what do you think about Tom's idea that you'd set up regional art centers that would be just open to all comers?
I think to a great extent that already exists. 40% of all the NEA funding goes to the state agencies, which then filters out through the various local arts agencies. And there's quite a bit of local input and control in that way. And I think there's quite a bit of decentralization of arts funding because of that as it is.
What about Tom's point also that the NEA does not have a good track record for choosing and funding great art? What kind of record do you think? This would be, of course, from before your tenure there, but what kind of record do you think the NEA has on that front?
I think very strong. We fund on the basis of peer review. We get the best people in the disciplines to look at the submissions and proposals. And my own sense is, at least to the extent I've been out in the field and talking to people, that we do a very good job of supporting and funding excellence. Now, there may be people who haven't gotten a grant or have been rejected that object. But I think, well, we make mistakes, but by and large, I think we do a very good job.
The individual grants that the NEA gave in the 1990s, some of them became very controversial. A lot of criticism from conservatives that the art produced was offensive. Now, I know that I've read that you would like to reinstate the possibility of giving grants to individual artists. Are you doing that now?
Well, we're not allowed to. There's a mandate by Congress that we're not allowed to do it. We do it in certain select areas. The Jazz Master Awards that we just presented are an example of that. We do some in literature, but by and large, we make grants to institutions rather than to artists directly. And I think that if we're the National Endowment for the Arts, the best way to support art is to support artists and to support them directly. That seems to me to be obvious. And it's one of the issues that I'm sure I'll be taking up with the right people in Congress going forward. I think we should support artists. I could spend the rest of the morning and afternoon with anecdotal stories about artists who have been supported by the NEA, and it's made a huge difference in their careers. My good friend Michael Eastman, who's a nationally renowned photographer, got his start with an NEA grant to improve his equipment.
But if you reinstate it, Congress allows you to reinstate grants to individual artists, how would you avoid some of these firestorms that have been in the past? Or do you think some of these controversies are okay to have?
I think a lot of that is in the past now. I think that the element in the conservative camp that was in an uproar about that have moved on to more important issues and have bigger fish to fry. I feel that those culture wars are really receding to a degree. I think you always have to be careful in how you make your grants and who and what you're supporting. But I just don't feel that that's a tinderbox the way it used to be.
Here's an email from Eileen, who's writing us from Vienna, Virginia. She says, I am an artist who has completed some public art commissions. I know some other artists who hear grumbling from the public that the money is wasted on some projects, that the artists are making too much money. What can the NEA and other public art organizations do to educate the public that artists deserve a paycheck too?
I think the median annual compensation for an artist is in the upper $20,000 area, so I don't think artists are getting rich unless you talk about those artists who are big Broadway movie stars. So I'm not worried about artists being overpaid a lot. I think we need to have much more significant support of artists and artists in this country, much more than we have now.
But you've been critical of the level of funding for the NEA. How much? What is your budget this year?
I think it's about $168 million for the year for the 2010 fiscal budget. Just to put that in perspective, the weakest funder of the arts in Europe is England in terms of public support of the arts. Their arts budget is about $900 million. That would translate on a per capita basis in this country to $4.6 billion, which I don't think is going to happen anytime soon. But we are way behind the curve in the developed world in terms of arts funding. There's no question.
And yet, the United States is home to a lot of the world's great art, great artists, despite the level of federal funding.
Well, we have great private sector support of the arts in this country, individuals most especially, but also foundations, and that's very, very important part of the arts scene here. The fact is, I think there's going to be some coming together of these forces. In Europe, there's a lot of talk about having a much more mixed source of arts funding, not just federal government support, but also a lot more private support. I think here we could probably live with a little more federal support, but the private sector has been very strong in this country.
The Obama administration will come out with its budget proposal on February 1st. This will be the first budget that fully reflects President Obama's priorities. Will we see a big jump in funding for the NEA?
That I can't comment on at all. I'm on a real lockdown in terms of any comments about the upcoming budget. So on that one question, I'll as they say in at the racetrack, I'll go to El Paso.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Well, okay, I have to ask you, what does I'll go to El Paso mean in the racetrack?
El Paso, you're going to pass.
I see. Now, you're known as a guy who likes the races.
I do. The big tragedy in my life is I haven't, in, I guess, 8 or 9 months now, I haven't been able to get to the track.
Because you're working
too
hard.
No time.
Yeah. Okay, let's go back to the phones. We'll go to New York City and talk to Isaac. Isaac, hi. Thanks for holding on.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good afternoon. Anyway, I have a question for Mr. Landesman. I'm a professional classical and jazz pianist and composer, and for the past 11 years, I've been part-time doing a music production at a local public school here in the Bronx. And what I noticed is that over the years, 11 years, that the aptitude of the student musicians have declined steadily to its very lowest level. The fact that public school students these days, the public schools are cutting music from their curricula, have led to a dearth of students with necessary skills to read music, even at a high school level. And now with the folk music, as I call it, or pop culture, dominating our country, it seems that real art has become irrelevant to the American people. So I was wondering what you could do to combat these challenges these days.
Isaac, sounds like you have a great program. Thanks so much for giving us a call.
It's funny you should ask me that right now. I just before I came over here, I had a meeting at the Department of Education, and they, Arne Duncan and his whole group there, are very committed to arts education and understand its role. We talked about how awful it is that when there's a budget crunch in the schools, the first thing that gets cut is arts education, and we feel that should be the last thing cut. That you know, your field is music. There's a lot of evidence, a lot of data that when you have a strong music education program, the same kids actually do much better at math. That there's a carry forward. They do when they're given a lot of arts education in the elementary schools, they do better in high school. And we're going to be making the case. We're going to be pounding the table for arts education through all of the educational system. And in fact, when we're talking about the democratization of the NEA, this is going to be one of our major areas where you'll see that. We're going to make sure that there's an arts education program in every congressional district.
I'm so sorry to hear Isaac's point, though, that he's seeing a decline in the musical training and the focus on music for the students he's dealing with.
It's a lack of arts education.
And is that an impact from No Child Left Behind?
Well, this whole notion of simply just training teachers to train kids to perform on standardized tests. I understand why they have it. They want some kind of accountability on behalf of the schools. But there are all these other kids who don't fit into that profile that have a legitimate role in our society, and there should be a place for them. And arts education is where a lot of those kids, in effect, get saved.
Now, you said you wanted to make sure, you and Arne Duncan, the education secretary, want to make sure there's an arts program in every congressional district or every school district?
I said, as chairman of the NEA, that we, the NEA, are going to make sure there's an arts education program in every congressional district. We'd like there to be one in every school district, of course. And we're going to be working with whomever we can, wherever we can. The Kennedy Center has a great pilot arts education program going on in Sacramento, California. And we talked about that this morning at the Department of Education. They have some very compelling ideas about what can be done. But it's going to be a major focus of the NEA, no question.
Will the Education Department do anything to modify some of the requirements of No Child Left Behind or take other steps to make it easier for school districts who get pulled in a lot of directions to maintain their arts programs?
I think they're very committed to arts programs within the schools and after the schools, after the school day. But there's another area where I think everyone can get involved. I think we will. I think the Department of Education is looking at that too. And that's also the whole area of arts charter schools. They have a fantastic one in New Orleans, another in Memphis, others. We're going to be doing that.
We'll talk more about that after the break. For now, we'll take a short break and we'll come back in a minute or two and go back to the phone. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. By the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. This is NPR.
Why does it take 60 votes to pass legislation in the Senate? What happened to simple majority rule? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with political scientist Gregory Koger, author of the upcoming book Filibustering, A Political History of Obstruction in the House and Senate. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm, and with me in the studio, Rocco Landisman, chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. Let's go back to the phones and take some of your calls. We've got a call from St. Louis, your hometown. Mike, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, and hi, Rocco. I admire what you're trying to do. I mean, and I'm curious, are you from the Landisman family that did the Gaslight Square?
The very same. Absolutely.
Okay, yeah. My
dad and my uncle had the Crystal Palace.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I've heard a lot over the years about that. I moved to St. Louis after it.
You probably heard about it from your grandparents.
Yeah. No, not quite. But anyway, I'm an artist too, actually a photographer, and my sister's a ballet dancer. But I've always been against the notion of federal subsidies for the arts. I've just been against it because I don't think it. It favors certain individuals who have access, political access. But my biggest problem is recently with the bailouts from corporations. What subsidizing anything does is justify the legality of subsidizing corporations, and we need to figure out how to back off from the corporations, and we really have to back off from everything that is of really free interest. And I think St. Louis has a tremendous amount of art. It's understated nationally, but it's clearly without a lot of subsidies, there's a lot of artists who struggle, and and yet then perform because they're struggling and they're having to justify what they do.
Well,
do you have any comments on that?
A lot of the art that you respond to and admire in St. Louis and elsewhere, in fact, does get a lot of subsidy from both private and public sources.
Well, art is legitimate.
Private sources are legitimate and public sources are not?
That's my sense, is that, you know, if somebody is willing to pay for your work, that's really the ultimate test, and it has to be. And I think art through the ages has always had private sponsors. I mean, the great artists of history have always had private sponsors who took up the best art and supported the artists.
I don't agree with that at all. You're applying a marketplace metric throughout. We don't apply it into other aspects of our national life. Should we say to the national parks, well, the marketplace will support you or not? If the people who want to use the national parks should pay for them, there should be no federal support or subsidy for them or even the national defense. I mean, we've determined that there are certain aspects of our natural life and character that are worthy of public support, and there are certain forms of art that have never been commercially viable or viable in the marketplace. Ballet, opera, jazz, certain aspects of artistic enterprise. Should we say they shouldn't exist? There's a minority of people who value them and support them, and to whom these things are very important, and they need subsidy. And I don't think we should just wave them off.
Of course, there might be taxpayers who would say, you know, ballet means nothing to me. Why should my tax dollars go to support the ballet?
Because there's a public interest in having a wide spectrum of civic and psychological engagement. And we do a lot of things. Our educational system, we do a lot of things that some individual will say, I'd like to opt out of. It doesn't concern me. Well, that's not the way our society works.
Mike, thanks for your call. Good luck with your photography and your sister's ballet. We'll talk to Kareem now. He's calling us from Alexandria, Virginia. Kareem, hi. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I guess a quick point. I was a teacher for a while, and to the previous caller's point, I imagine every one of my students would have said, "I see no value in learning math," and thank God we don't give them that.
Exactly. And why should I pay for this? It doesn't concern me.
Exactly.
And it's a ridiculous system. Ridiculous point.
Pay for the economic system we've created, which is a bit of a conundrum. Anyway.
And by the way, I don't think there's necessarily a logic follows that if you support an artist who's struggling to survive on $20,000 a year, this means that you're going to be supporting big corporations as a matter of course.
No, absolutely. Here's my question. Is, like I said, I was a teacher for a while, and I recently started a company called Mathalicious, and what we do is we create math content for teachers, and we'll explore, you know, the math of politics, of history. We'll use golden ratio to explore Da Vinci, for instance. And so in the same way that we view math as a tool to explore the world around us, do you view art as a standalone discipline, or do you think that it should actually be best incorporated into something like history the same way that Picasso, you know, explored Guernica? I mean, was very integrated into, you know, the politics of the day. And a second question very quickly is, how would you or the NEA define art? I mean, is it an end product like a photograph or a painting, or is it an ethic? And if it's an ethic, could somebody like Mathalicious apply for an NEA grant, even though we are not traditionally artistic, but guided by what we think is a pretty reasonable artistic ethic?
Kareem, that's so interesting. Thanks for your call.
Well, the answer to your first question, which has an either or, is yes. I believe in both. I believe in the value of art for art's sake, or I sometimes call it art for Pete's sake, that it has an intrinsic value. But I also believe that it can integrate into the educational system, into a curriculum, into a spectrum of engagement that can be very, very important. One of the most thrilling things that happened to me since I've been in this position was going down to New Orleans and visiting the Lusher School, which is an arts charter school. And not only is it thrilling just the way they go about their business, the day starts with the music teacher coming down and with an electric guitar, and the kids are out in the yard, and they begin the day singing Fats Domino songs, and they're hugging and dancing, and imagine starting your school day with that kind of an up feeling. But you go into the classroom and you see how arts are integrated into the curriculum. They don't even think of themselves as an art school. They think of themselves just as a school, but arts is so essential and integrated into that culture there, that art is used in every single way. Van Gogh becomes an avenue into studying French history. And it's all totally seamless and integrated, and it's thrilling to see the way that that works. So the answer to that first question is both.
Well, what about the other question that he asked, which was, would a program like Mathalicious, which is a great name, by the way, could it apply to the NEA for a grant?
Yes, to the extent that there was any, however tenuous, arts function. I mean, sometimes we do expand our notion of the arts to a lot of what we would call creative enterprise, creative activity, imaginative activity. And I think math can certainly often qualify as part of creative and imaginative activity, no question.
We've gotten a lot of emails about the controversies from the culture war era of the NEA and other controversies involving public funding of controversial art. Here's one of them. This person writes, when I hear talk about standards in connection with the arts, I bristle. Part of the problem with the NEA and arts in general is that standards are impossible to create on an objective level, hence the Mapplethorpe controversy. The other issue is in connection with the previous show in that the Supreme Court has decided that corporations can express their First Amendment rights. What about artists such as Mapplethorpe?
Well, I don't want to get in the middle of the Mapplethorpe controversy. He was certainly a legitimate and respected artist. I do think that there are standards that can be applied to art as there are to any other field. There are standards in mathematics and in science and in every other endeavor. Why shouldn't there be an art? Why do people have somehow this notion that every opinion in art is as good as any other? S.J. Perlman had one of my favorite lines about this. He said, I don't know much about medicine, but I know what I like. There are ways to have evaluations and standards, and I just reject that that's impossible.
Some emailers are questioning whether if you increase funding for the arts, government funding for the arts, you're inevitably going to encounter some of these controversies. Here's an email from Calder writing us from Jacksonville, Florida. How does your guest plan to promote the arts without overly politicizing art? I'm thinking specifically of the 1999 show at the Brooklyn Museum that politicians during election year found too offensive and acted to revoke the museum's lease and remove its municipal funding unless the museum took down the show.
I don't know what happened there. I don't remember it at all. But I am very, very adamantly against the politicization of art both ways. Either art that is in effect propaganda, that is, you know, I have a real visceral aversion to what is sometimes called message art. I can't stand it, and I hope the NEA isn't going to fund it. On the other side, I think it's a terrible mistake if a politician wades into an artistic enterprise in a very heavy-handed way and tries to get rid of something because he or she doesn't like it. I think that's equally reprehensible.
Let's go to Frankfort, Michigan, and talk to Camille. Camille, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Every time I hear a discussion about the arts, and I don't know how much influence the NEA can have with arts education, but I feel I need to express that the purpose for arts, the need for arts, especially in education, in our culture, in our society, is essential. I was a good math student. I was a good science student, but it was the arts that my life.
You're preaching to the choir here.
Okay, and but also that as concerned as I am about the kinds of images that children are exposed to these days, I don't think that censoring art is exactly it starts in school with allowing children to really have an expression. It doesn't the other
all right
capacities and the other subjects.
Camille, you're breaking up a little bit. You must be on a cell phone. What do you think?
Well, I think I'm not big on any kind of censorship, but I think where kids are involved, I think there is some legitimate discretion that has to be applied. I think kids are vulnerable, and I do believe in some sort of screening process in terms of what's appropriate for them.
All right, let's go to another caller from Salt Lake City. Marion's on the phone. Marion, now you're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I grew up in Toronto, Canada, and in the fifth grade, an art school came to my school and started saying how they had this arts education program and you had to audition to enroll. And so I found this to be so enticing and exciting, and I asked my mother, and I auditioned, and I got in for the 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. And included in your curriculum for math and science and all of that was dance, drama, instrumental music, vocal music. And I soon realized, actually in hindsight, that I was a terrible student academically, but I thrived in the arts. And so the only reason I did well in school was because I had, you know, dance to look forward to after my math class.
I wish we could put you on a big public billboard in every city.
Yeah, no kidding. And so then in seventh grade, you think about what you're going to do in your high school career. And there was a school that was about an hour by bus called Unionville Arts, Unionville High School for the Performing Arts. And so I auditioned for that, and I got into that. And then my parents subsequently got divorced. My mother and I moved to a far suburb, and I kept taking the public transit to school, which took me an hour there and an hour back. And, you know, boys got involved, and your social life flourishes and all that stuff. And so I eventually, feeling like the commute was much too much, and I ended up going to a public school in my local area. And I quickly realized how horrible of a student I was. I ended up dropping out of high school and ended up going back. But to make a long story short, there are students who will thrive in school if arts are included in abundance, like, you know, just beyond, you know, visual arts and music, like dance and vocal music. And I, now that I'm a mother of two, I think to myself, what am I going to do when my kids enroll? What if they aren't fantastic or don't have the academic achievement levels of other children? And I just wonder what I'm going to do when they reach the time when these decisions have to be made. So I really appreciate the show today, and I hope maybe soon it'll be included in our public schools the way they were included in my education.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I think what you have to do is make sure you choose schools that have, you know, when and where you can, of course, schools that have a strong arts education component.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. You know, we've gotten an emailer talking about St. Louis's Gaslight Square. You mentioned your family's connection with that and your father's, the fact that your father was running the Crystal Palace in St. Louis. What kind of performers did you see there?
Oh, it was an amazing place. It was really, as much as anywhere, the birthplace of improvisational theater in this country, the Compass Players. That was Mike Nichols and Elaine May and Del Close and Severn Darden and a lot of people who became famous after Second City became well known, and it was a place where there was a lot of artistic ferment, a lot of risk taking. I think at the Crystal Palace they did the second American production of Waiting for Godot. It was an exciting place to be, an exciting place to hang around. Very unusual for a city like St. Louis to have this kind of bohemian enclave where exciting work was being done, and that's very much a part of my background and something I have a great deal of nostalgia for.
How has that shaped, do you think, your own association with the arts, not just at the NEA, but also on Broadway?
Well, I think to some extent it got me interested in the arts in the first place. That was very much in my background. I started acting in plays in high school and college and always had an interest in that and went to the Yale School of Drama largely because of that background.
Now, here's an email from Leslie Kaplan of St. Louis, and Leslie writes, I acted with Rocco when we were in high school.
Hi, Leslie. Good to hear from you.
And he was so talented. Rocco, why did you give up your acting career? You were the liveliest corpse I ever saw. What does that mean?
I was so talented at a high school and, to some extent, college level. I'm not sure I was so talented at a professional level, so I had to make my career in a different way. But I look back on all those plays with fond memories.
And you were cast as a corpse?
That I'm trying to remember. That might have been a J.M. Singh play. I'm not sure.
We've been glad to
Riders
have
to the Sea.
Rocco Landisman on the phone with us this hour on the Diane Rehm Show. He's chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Susan. Thanks for having me.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.